Hello again, Trippers. Alex Zane here, film journalist, movie fan, and your host for another glorious episode of A Trip to the Movies. Thanks for joining me today. I'm currently in our podcast studio, a mile beneath the streets of London, and in a moment, my guest this week, Thea Sharrock, takes us all on her perfect trip to the movies. Thank you for downloading the podcast. This episode is brought to you by Odeon, because if you're going to watch a movie, it has to be at an Odeon Luxe. For me, there's no better place to experience the mesmerizing magic of the big screen. And when I say big, I mean crystal clear, four times sharper, larger than life, I sense big. A place where you can recline in luxury whilst sipping on your favorite tipple as you immerse yourself in the all-consuming power of the story, enriched by epic Dolby Atmos that'll make your spine tingle and the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. Now that is how to experience a movie. And there's no better feeling. You can book your Odeon Luxe experience at odeon.co.uk or via the My Odeon app. Odeon say, we make movies better, and they're not wrong. And if you'd like to watch today's interview in glorious Technicolor, do head over to our YouTube channel, where the video goes up a few days after the pod. And for all the latest updates, or to get in touch with us, you'll find us at Trip to Movies Pod on all social media. Right then, if you're ready, let's do this. Hello and welcome to the show where each week a special guest takes us on their perfect trip to the movies. This week we're joined by a brilliant director of stage and screen. Among her many stage credits, she directed Daniel Radcliffe in the 2007 revival of Equus. She began her big screen filmmaking career with the 2016 Emilia Clarke romantic drama Me Before You, and more recently this year's Wicked Little Letters with Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley. Now, only a month after that film's release, she's bringing the tremendous football drama The Beautiful Game to Netflix on March the 29th. Starring Bill Nighy and Michael Ward, it charts the fortunes of the English team at the 2021 Homeless World Cup. Here to tell us about that film and take us on her perfect trip to the movies, it's the wonderful Thea Sharrock. Thea, so wonderful to have you on the show. Hey, this is a bit of a first for me. I don't think I've interviewed a filmmaker who has had two major motion pictures out in the space of literally a month. So we're talking Wicked Little Letters came out literally last month, and this comes out 29th of March. That's crazy.
It's crazy. And if you were in America, it would be even more crazy because they're both coming out on the same day.
Oh, that must be one for the record books. I don't know that that's ever happened before.
I don't know. It wasn't planned, but I'm delighted. I'm absolutely delighted.
Congratulations. Does it feel a bit hectic, though? Is it a bit crazy, like managing both films? Have you found yourself going, which movie am I talking about today?
Yes and no. I guess Wicked Little Letters is obviously ahead of itself, so I've got very used to talking about that. But the funny thing is I shot Beautiful Game first, and I can't wait to start talking about that. So I'm delighted that we'll be talking about it today.
We are. And what's even more exciting is this is probably going to be the closest to finishing watching the film and doing the interview you're going to have from an interviewer. I watched it literally this morning, so I'm coming to it very fresh. Very fresh.
Very fresh. Wow. Okay, good. How'd you get on?
Oh, do you know what? I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I laughed. I cried. And this is coming from someone who doesn't like sport, but loves a sports drama. What attracted you to this?
Wow. Well, let me just ask you, so you don't like sport, but you love watching sport as part of a story.
I love the construct of a sports drama. You know, take any example, you know, that final kick, that final throw, the person who's not a team player who becomes a team player, this group of, you know, disjointed individuals who then form this winning team. I love that.
Okay, so it's like the people who make up the sport you love, but actually watching the sport, you don't really go in for that.
Do you know what? If I committed to it, because it is, I guess it is like a soap opera sport anyway. I mean, all the people who watch Transfer Day, I don't know what that is, but I'm aware that it exists. I'm guessing they create their own narratives and the sports reporters create the narratives, but I like it packaged up in 2 hours of filmmaking entertainment.
Right, right, right. I get it. Because actually, if you were to take the Premier League, for example, during the course of the entire season, you will get the most amazing highs and lows of drama.
Okay.
But you're right. You've got to do it. It's going to be spread out over a course of time. Except, of course, now, All or Nothing, that series, I think it's on Prime. Have you seen any of those? That's probably episodes, films. That's probably too long for you, isn't it?
Right. Is it factual or is it fiction?
No, it's factual. So it's following the stories, but they are real people. And the drama, it's really well pitched, I think. But it is real people. So also it's to do with, it's fiction. I love this. This is great. This is really interesting.
I feel like I'm talking to a sports fan then. Are you a sports fan? I guess. Are
Massive.
You a football fan as
Massive.
Well then? Right.
Massive. I've got an older brother who sort of just pummeled me into it, really. And then I think I was about 10 or 11. He took me to my first live football game. He took me to an Arsenal game, and it was absolutely thrilling. This is back when we were still standing in the crowd, and it had so much drama within it. But it was also kind of physically, it was quite scary because I was a lot smaller than most of the people around us. So I just remember that feeling of him wanting to protect me. So he plays a big role in that. And then I just fell in love with it. And so, yeah, I'm a huge sports fan and I do love watching it.
And I'm guessing an Arsenal supporter then.
Huge.
Right.
Die hard, you might say.
I'm going to throw this out there. This is based on passive imbibing of sports media. You're doing quite well.
We're doing all right.
All right. Okay.
We're doing all right. We are. It's a pleasure. As a lifelong Arsenal fan, it's kind of weird but glorious to be so proud of how well the team are now doing.
So based on all this information, this was a no-brainer for you. I mean, did it?
This is a total no-brainer for me. Let me tell you the pitch, right?
Yeah.
So, and crucially, this was in the spring of 2021, back in that COVID time where none of us really knew what the rhythm of our lives were going to be. Everything had been upended. I'd spent, I guess, nearly a year pretty much at home, two kids. You know, all that online schooling nightmare. And I luckily I had just finished a film for Disney when COVID hit. So that managed, you know, that didn't stop that film, which was great, but it meant that I'd had this enforced period of time out, which actually looking back at it was probably brilliant. And again, my kids were at the right stage. So my point is I'd stepped into a new life. I'd had this whole new rhythm and none of us really knew how and when we were going to come out of it. And I got this text message from Pete Chanin, who works with Graham Broadbent at Blueprint Pictures. And Pete is somebody I'd known now for quite a few years, mainly because Pete's a massive Liverpool fan. And we would go out whenever we were both in London and we'd go and have lunch and we'd just talk about football. And then at the end of it, he would say, oh, God, let me just talk to you about a few scripts that we're doing. So he sends me a message and he says, let's get on a Zoom. That's what people do now. Remember back in the day when Zoom was a new thing. So we get on a Zoom and he basically said, look, we've got this script. At the time, it wasn't called the Buford Game. It was called something else. But he said, it's football. It's based on the Homeless World Cup. It's for Netflix. We're shooting in Rome with Bill Nighy. What do you think? And I was like, what do I think? He's like, do you want to read the script? I said, yes. So it was a very, very easy ask. And from there, we got Michael Ward and then went through the sort of incredible process of trying to put the rest of the team together, literally. And it was amazing. It was really, really a unique experience.
I mean, my excuse, as I've already pointed out, is my just complete lack of interest in sports. So I was not even aware that this Homeless World Cup existed, which is an actual thing. It's been going over 20 years now. Were you aware of this, or was the script a doorway into this world?
The script was totally a doorway into it. And the script was based or inspired by, obviously, not only the real thing, but Colin Farrell had made Kicking It, which is a documentary based on the Homeless World Cup, which is absolutely brilliant. It's brilliant. He literally follows, it's mainly the Irish team as they get chosen, and then what it's like for them to go to South Africa and take part. And he then meets also lots of other players. And, you know, it just opens your mind and your heart to the kind of extraordinary social issue that is homelessness and how that affects so many different people in so many different ways and the stigma inevitably that comes with it. But the most uplifting thing is that what this tournament does is it enables people to literally to give themselves a second chance. They become part of a team. Doesn't matter what your skill level is. It's not about that. It's about taking part in something that literally can start to recharge and kind of almost refind yourself, to be honest, and find a level of self-worth that so many people have lost through this often incredibly unfair journey that they particularly have gone on. To find themselves homeless. And it's an incredible foundation that, yeah, as you say, it's been running for nearly 25 years. And a lot of people in the world haven't heard about it. And that's part of the joy of this movie and hopefully getting it out there. People will suddenly realize what an amazing foundation it is.
I think your film really captures that. And I think it also does a really good job of, as you just said, the stigma attached to homelessness. You mentioned Michael Ward's character, Vinny, who at the start very much doesn't even want to admit he's homeless to Bill Nighy's character, Mal.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny because as soon as I met Michael, we talked about that aspect of the character and he found that really easy to understand. He found actually Vinny's journey and how somebody can go from almost 1 minute having seemingly everything from the outside and then having your entire world pretty much ripped away from underneath you and again having to start again. So when we first meet him in the movie, he's already trying so hard to reestablish his life and create some kind of foundation. And he's not doing a great job of it because he's not feeling very good about himself. And again, through the experience of the tournament, he refinds himself and he opens himself up to what it is to be part of something bigger than you.
I mean, what a talent Michael Ward is. I mean, at his age, multiple BAFTA nominee already. He's so good. Can he play football? Is that him? Was that a requirement?
It was definitely a requirement. And actually, when Michael was young, he used to play a lot of football.
Right.
And funny enough, I don't want to speak too much for him, but he had a similar story in the sense that, like many young boys, men, that moment of realization when you're not actually going to be a professional footballer can be absolutely heartbreaking. And he just brought the curtain down on football in his life and just went, that's it. And he needed to distance himself massively. So he stopped playing, he pretty much stopped watching, he just, you know, put it on a shelf, as it were. And so when I first met him, he said, you know, I said, can you play? And he said, yeah, I can play, but the biggest challenge for me is I've needed to find a reason to get back on a pitch, to get back into the changing room. And this movie did it. So I will say there was a lot of training and we had an amazing coach, Mike Delaney. And he worked very, very, very hard, and it's all him.
He's great. He's fantastic, and you touched on Bill Nighy as well. I mean, gosh, I mean, you are racking up a CV of national treasures you are working with. I mean, Olivia Colman, Timothy Spall in Wicked Little Letters, and now Bill Nighy. I have never had the chance to interview him. I'm a little bit in love with him. What's he like to work with? Because he was already attached when you joined then.
He was. And he really believed in the project for all the right reasons. So it was amazing to meet him for the first time. Well, let's just say that I was a little bit in love with Bill before I met him, and now I'm a lot of it in love with Bill. I will say, a bit like Olivia, he, actually, like Tim, like all the people you've mentioned, Bill is exactly what you think he's going to be. He is an absolute gentleman. He is unbelievably professional. He is so articulate and carefully prepared for everything, every conversation, every scene that you work on, every aspect of filmmaking. He became the person who I would often go to ask him his advice or his thoughts. He was like my sounding board, if you like, even on parts of the movies that he wasn't necessarily in. Because he's just got that generosity. He's got incredible experience. He's done it all. And like me, he comes from a theatre background. So we also, in terms of how best to work with different people and different actors and what it is that we've learned over the years, those sorts of conversations never stop. He's also a massive football fan, so we always had a lot to talk about.
There's a moment in this which I can't remember the last time I saw Bill Nighy give a moment like this, because we're so used to seeing him give these loose, very calm, like this almost sing-song delivery of dialogue. And then when he loses it with the ref during that first game, I was like, he's not just breaking like character in terms of like doing something opposite today. I've not seen Bill Nighy lose his temper like that on film. It's such a great moment.
That's funny. I didn't know if you were going to talk about that moment, or not to give away too much, or the moment right at the end, which is another, for me, it's another first in terms of Bill. But yeah, I mean, funny enough, Bill was so in control of that moment of anger that it didn't feel unexpected when I saw it. And we talked it all through and everything. I mean, it was a joy to watch. It was an absolute joy to watch. Yeah, God. The funny thing about that one was, of course, we could only go one or two times because his vocally, he gave absolutely everything, as is totally his way. And, you know, that's the kind of thing he thinks about. He says to me, Thea, but before we go, let's do a couple of rehearsals, just a walkthrough, because I when I give it to you, I want to give it all, and I don't know if I can do it more than twice. Anyway, yeah, God, he's a legend. He's absolutely, he's very, very, very special.
Well, I don't doubt he was channeling in that moment every time he's felt like that about a ref. Knowing he's a football fan now, that was probably very, very cathartic for him. I mean, he knew exactly what he was doing there. We're going to talk more about The Beautiful Game as we go on our journey. But right now, Thea, it is time to leave this dimension and head into another reality where our virtual cinema awaits. You are our guide. We are your audience. Let's go on your perfect trip to the movies. So we push open the door to our temple of film and find ourselves in the foyer. There's an excited buzz, as there always is in a cinema foyer, the hum of anticipation. It's your perfect cinema trip. Who have you picked, living or dead, to go with you?
I've picked Alan Rickman, who was a great friend, and I think anybody who was lucky enough to have him in their lives still misses him. He was completely unique. One of the most generous people I've ever met, and also one of the best listeners and the most considerate men. He would never, ever say anything without carefully having thought through what it was he wanted to say. So his choice of words, his warmth, dry sense of humor, he was just somebody who you always wanted to know his opinion. So the idea of him coming back for a day and us being able to go to the cinema is special.
Oh, that's amazing. So he was a friend of yours as well, someone you worked with.
Yeah, yeah. He was on the board when I ran a theatre at The Gate in West London. That's how I met him. That's how I got to know him very carefully. And yeah, we stayed friends.
That's amazing. It's interesting. I'm reading his diaries at the moment.
It
was
a
gift for Christmas, which I'm slightly confused. I read that no one's certain whether he even wanted them published, but nevertheless, it's nice to be able to get an insight into his mind. It's a fascinating read.
I think he didn't write them to be published, but as you know, not just the words, but also some of the drawings and illustrations, he pored over them. He took so much time over them that it suddenly felt like the right thing to do after a number of years of him going. It was like a gift of getting a little bit of him back.
I love it. Right, It's Yourself and the great Alan Rickman going to the cinema. Now, there is a clock on the wall in the foyer. It reads a specific time. What time of day have we gone to the cinema?
8:00 p.m.
Okay. Just straight in there. No questions asked. 8 p.m.
So Perfect movie time.
It's a great movie time. It's a busy cinema. Most people do go to the cinema in the evening still. So I'm guessing in picking that time, you like a busy auditorium.
Do you know what? At the same time, if you said to me, Theo, I've got you a ticket for the cinema, it's 12 o'clock and there's only one ticket and there'll be three other people in the cinema, I'd love it. I literally love going to the cinema any time of day or night, and packed or empty, it feeds the experience. Of course, there are certain moments where if you're watching a comedy, for example, it's kind of delicious to be in a nice full auditorium and hear lots of people laughing, and that shared experience is wonderful. But equally, I love a quiet experience on my own with just a few people. You know, it can even be 10 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I'm going to put you at 8 p.m. Can I ask, have you had chance to watch The Beautiful Game with an audience on the big screen?
I have.
Okay.
The very first screening that we did was actually in LA. We flew to America to do the preview there in an absolutely just a classic West Coast American cinema. Huge screen, huge seats, completely full, massively diverse crowd, really interesting, age-wise, ethnicity, everything. Male, female, they'd done an amazing recruit. So it was like a real mishmash. And a few Brits up at the back who'd made the movie. And it was brilliant. Seeing it on that massive screen was superb. It was really, really, really special.
And this wasn't a test screening. It was. Oh, it was?
It was the first preview. Yeah.
Okay. So it just talked me through your headspace as that movie begins at the first public screening of the movie. How are you feeling when it begins?
Well, it helps in a moment like that when you have literally just flown into the city. So I had time to fly in, get to the hotel, unpack my bag, and get back into a car essentially and go and find the cinema. I had lots going on, so I didn't. It sort of felt exciting, felt like a real adventure. So I was really cool about it. I arrived at the cinema and there were my producers, whom I adore. It was so lovely to see them. They had already been there. And then guys from Netflix, who equally I hadn't seen for a while. So that bit, I kind of got lost in why we were there. It was more about who I was with. And then it's not until you go into the cinema and you sit down in your seat and all these people are coming in and you're like, just remembered why we're in here. And it's so vulnerable making. It's literally like somebody just says, okay, if you could just take all your clothes off right now and don't stand in front of everybody. It's literally like that. And even though you know, and you've already signed up for taking all your clothes off and standing in front of people, even in the moment when they turn to you and they go, okay, now's the moment, you just go, hang on a second, do we have to do this? It's painful, man. Birthing a film is painful, but it's always been worth it. It's also really special, that moment when, you know, what's really lovely is when you get an unexpected laugh. So you've been sitting in the edit for all these months and there's a few things that you always think is funny or you think is great or whatever. And then out of nowhere, the audience suddenly gets something and they see something or they hear something in a way that is just slightly different to how you have seen it and heard it. And suddenly that is the moment when the movie stops being yours and it's there for everybody else. And that's an amazing feeling.
And so to fast forward to the credits rolling at that screening, how did you feel then compared to how you felt at the start? I'm assuming it was received well because it's a wonderful film.
It was received really well. Big smile.
Yeah.
Big smile. Yeah.
Because I love American audiences. To talk about the communal experience, they are a very vocal crowd. They interact with that picture in a way we do not here in the UK.
Do you know what? I couldn't agree more. You're 100% right. It's really, really lovely. I had it quite recently on for Wicked Little Letters. We did a very small test screening in England, but really the first test audience was Toronto Film Festival, which when we got accepted into that, that was basically our end point. We had to finish it in time for Toronto. So it was like a mad dash to the end. Got to Toronto, which was incidentally during still in the strike period. So I didn't have Olivia and Jesse with me, which you would normally have. So the whole thing, again, felt a bit weird. And even more, it was like, boy, I don't know how this is going to go down. That audience in Toronto, it was an enormous house, enormous. And they were just fantastic. They're just terrific. They just don't hold back. I know that's Toronto, Canada, as opposed to America, but we're saying the same thing. Mm. They wear their hearts on their sleeves. It's really gorgeous being in the room with them, which also means it can be punishing. Because if they get bored, my God, they will leave the auditorium. They have no holds barred, which you get much less of over here.
We're so polite.
But we're so polite. We just hang on in there. I'm lucky in that every film I've done has had some kind of test screening over there. And I've always been really grateful for it.
Right then. Well, it's an 8 p.m. screening we're attending. Now, you have booked the tickets for us. Thank you very much. Where in the auditorium have you booked the seats? Where will we be sitting?
We're going to sit middle, which is always, for me, the sweet spot for sound. And that's crucial. As you'll see from the beautiful game, the music is an essential part of the film. Ugh. And I want you always to be sitting in the sweet spot.
Lovely. Some great needle drops. The Clash, Magnificent Seven. Love that. Love that.
Thank you. Yeah, we weren't sure if we'd get them, but we got them.
Yeah, well done. Well done. It's a great moment. It's a great moment. All right, yeah. As a filmmaker, we figured you'd pick middle. It is definitely the best place in the auditorium for sound. It's the most favoured seat on the show. So great. We're sitting there. Final thing we need before we leave the foyer. The air is full of wonderful smells. All manner of snacks and foodstuffs are available at the millions of counters. What are you choosing to eat?
There's only ever one for me. Gotta be sweet popcorn.
Okay, done. Sweet popcorn. No mix. You never sort of covet the saltiness?
I never mix. And also, let's be clear, I'm not talking Butterkissed. Mm. Nothing against Butterkissed, but that's not what I'm talking old-fashioned, being scooped around by the lady behind the desk. It's got to be warm, it's got to be fresh, and it's got to be sweet.
Yeah, I hear you. Have you ever managed to, when you've been in America, try their butter popcorn? It comes up a lot with American guests on the show. It sounds both delicious and also something that someone shouldn't ingest at the same time.
It is such a classic American thing for me. It's one of the disappointing things sometimes going to the cinema in America. Unless you want chocolate or something like that, often the popcorn experience is not up to it for me. Okay. It's a slight letdown.
Okay. Well, I'll bear that in mind, but we are in your perfect cinema, so you are having the perfect warm, sweet popcorn from the counter. Let's leave the foyer. We have everything we need. We push open the doors to the corridor towards the auditorium. Now, the corridor's looking a little bare at the moment, so I'm going to put up some posters that illustrate your most important movie memories. And the first poster depicts your fondest movie memory.
So my fondest has to be the first that came to my mind, which is the first time I ever went to a cinema. My dad took me to Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh, wow. Can I ask how old you were?
So I must have been about 9.
Okay. Because that is, I think, if I'm right in my movie trivia, that's the movie that introduced the PG-13, because that is... That's a scary movie for a kid.
Is that right? Oh, God, maybe I've got my timing wrong. Maybe it was a bit later then, or maybe it wasn't when it very first came out. But I know for sure it was Indiana Jones. I don't think it was, unless it was a rerun of later, because I think Raiders was more like 81, something like that.
Yeah, that sounds
so
about
it can't
right,
have
yeah.
been that. But to be honest, what I remember most was I remember the foyer. I remember waiting for the ticket, and I remember Harrison Ford. So I can't, but I assumed it was Temple of Doom, rather.
I mean, that this is Temple of Doom is the one where
we could have all three, though, couldn't we?
I mean, we could.
We could just go retro and have them all.
We could put them all up.
I would love to have a bit. I've got to have a bit of Kasdan up there. Larry Kasdan is somebody I'm lucky enough to have worked with and absolutely adore. And somewhere in that, in a prime position in our corridor, you've got to have Larry Kasdan.
He is.
In fact, we could do a whole wall. We could do the Big Chill. We could do the Bodyguard. We, you know, Body Heat, you name it.
Yeah.
How about that for a retro? I mean, that would be superb.
He's a very talented writer. And Temple of Doom, in hindsight now, seeing as you mentioned all the Indiana Jones movies, where do you put that in the scorecard of best Indiana Jones movies? Because it normally falls around third place after Last Crusade and Raiders for a lot of people.
Yeah, Raiders is number one for me.
Okay. Okay,
and that's also why I'm sure that it was the first one I saw, because I had nothing for it to go against. I had no comparison to make.
Okay, well, that would be Raiders then. But you know what? It doesn't matter. Let's put up all three posters: Raiders, Temple of Doom, and Last Crusade. We're leaving off Kingdom and Dial of Destiny, though, because that's not retro. That's not retro.
That's not retro. No, we're going retro. Those posters are the best, also.
Yeah, they are. Classic. Are they Drew Struzan? They feel like Drew Struzan posters.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Right. We're putting up three. I'm letting you have three posters. The Indiana Jones first trilogy. Let's carry on down the corridor. The second poster depicts your worst movie memory.
Well, I'm carrying on a theme here. I had no idea that Han Solo was ever going to die. And I was lucky enough to be at the premiere in Leicester Square with my kids. Absolutely heartbreaking moment. Absolutely heartbreaking. Gobstop. I couldn't believe it. But what a magical piece of movie making. Superb.
That's okay. So I was going to ask. So it's not that you didn't feel he should have died. It's the fact that him dying broke you.
Just broke me. Just broke me as an individual in that moment.
And you didn't expect it to happen, despite the fact that I think for about a decade, Harrison Ford has been going, if I do it again, I have to die. I'm going to kill this character. I want to kill Han Solo.
Yes, but I still didn't go in. And don't forget, you know, at that moment, nobody knew. Nobody'd seen it. There were absolutely no spoilers. So, you know, I went on the journey. I went on the journey and Kasdan broke my heart again. But in a superb fashion.
So to touch on the theme you're going with, I'm guessing you're something of a Harrison Ford fan.
Yes.
Right. Because of the characters he plays or because he's a wonderful actor? Because obviously we're talking about the same thing here. I mean, Han Solo, Indiana Jones were the two icons of my childhood as well. So was it that? Did he just become these characters for you? Or do you think outside of these two behemoth franchises, he's an actor you love?
Oh, no, he's definitely an actor I love. I mean, Witness, even, you know, regarding Henry, it's definitely, even, what was the Into the Wild? No, what was it called? The film not that long ago, a couple of years ago, from that kid's book, where...
What happens?
You know, he lives in the mountains and he befriends a wolf, basically.
Oh, my God. I don't know that one.
It's even that, I'm saying, from a few years ago. I think he's wonderful. And I don't think anybody has quite slipped into those shoes.
Mm. Yeah. The Fugitive.
Fugitive. Oh, my God. Yeah. What a film. Mm.
Yeah. Dr. Kimball. It's weird. Until he shaves off the beard, I don't really believe he's Harrison Ford, though. I can't. I always struggled with Harrison Ford with a beard. I'm like, shave the beard. Get the beard off. Oh, now there's Harrison Ford doing cool stuff. Great. Okay. We're putting up a poster for The Force Awakens as your worst movie memory because Han Solo dies. And the third poster we're putting up as we carry on down the corridor depicts the last performance that brought you to tears.
Gotta be All of Us Strangers. Andrew Scott, Claire Foy, and in particular the moment when they are lying in bed together and she asks him how he's doing.
Oh.
And that broke me. That absolutely broke me. I just thought that whole movie had such a deft touch. The performances were all utterly extraordinary. And it also, it was a movie that really fed me intellectually, emotionally, it just gave so much. I thought it was really, really beautiful piece of work.
An incredible film. And that the story, I mean, as a filmmaker, you may have a different insight into what that must be like. But Andrew Haig deciding to film a very personal movie about his own childhood in his childhood home sounds like such an interesting thing to do for a director.
All I can say is I totally get it. Once you've had that idea, if it feels right, I can see why he would have done everything to make it possible. It's a great thought that either makes or breaks that movie, and it was clearly where he needed to go. I mean, literally where, and physically and mentally where he needed to go. So, yeah, really special.
You said it fed you intellectually. So you mentioned Graham Broadbent at the start. He's a friend, or he was involved in The Beautiful Game, or he spoke to you about The Beautiful Game.
No, so I initially knew his partner at Blueprint, Pete Janine, right, who runs Blueprint with Graham, and I didn't really know Graham at that stage.
Okay.
Pete gave me the script for what became The Beautiful Game, and I read it immediately, came back, and I was like, I'm in. These are my notes. And he was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Not actually my movie. It's Graham's movie. And I was like, wait, what? And he said, yeah, this is Graham. And so I met Graham properly over Zoom. First thing Graham tells me is he's certainly not a football fan. And I was like, hang on a second, but Pete is a massive football fan. So how is it that you're making this movie? Anyway, but the two of us together, I think, made a great pair. And I love him to pieces. I think he's the best. And I was very, very lucky that he was free and he could come and join me also on Wicked Little Letters. So we made those together. And he also made All of Us Strangers. So I think he's, you know, as a company, they're brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant. And their taste is impeccable.
He's great. I had the chance to interview him for the first time, actually, for All of Us Strangers, and I told him
Graham.
Right. And to talk about it feeding you intellectually, I gave him my theory about what is happening in the movie, because obviously there's the fire. I'm just going to, if you've got 2 minutes, I'll just tell you it. You can tell me what you think, and then I'll tell you what Graham said. So my theory about it, and this is going to be a spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen All of Us Strangers, so be aware, you should go see it. So my theory was there's a fire alarm at the start, and then there's at least 3 needle drops which involve the word fire. Andrew Scott's character throughout starts coughing more and more like he's inhaling smoke. And so I thought at the end, when he and Paul Mescal disappear into the cosmos together, I thought he died too, because at the start the fire was real and he was actually in an apartment filling with smoke over the course of the movie and dies at the end. What are your thoughts, Thea?
Love it. Absolutely love it.
Oh, great. Thank you. Graham
what did
said,
Graham say?
I don't
what
know
a
where
load
you
tosh I've never heard.
Yep. He went, well, that's just wrong.
But you see, yeah, this is what's wonderful, right, about doing what we do, is creating something that if you're lucky enough to create something where there are no boundaries in terms of what people's takeaway is. So I think that's brilliant. I love it.
I'll tell you my last performance that brought me to tears. It was in your movie, which was this morning. I found myself crying over my laptop in the kitchen. It's such
with
a
your cornflakes.
With my cornflakes, I can't eat cereal anymore. I can't even eat carbs. So I've hit that age. But that's besides the point. It's the moment in your movie, which is such a beautiful moment. It's because there's a little bit of misdirection, and then there's the reveal when the character Nathan is in the airport and his mum calls him, and you think, because he's just had a little bit of a to-do with her the previous night, and then she calls him, and you think, oh, she's ringing him to say good luck. This is a bit of a spoiler, but it's a mini spoiler. She's ringing him to say, actually, have a great time in Rome at the World Cup. And then she's there. She goes, turn around. It hit me right here.
Oh, that's so sweet. Why do you think that hit you so strongly? Were you just with him in that moment, or was it about their relationship? Or
I think it's a few things. I think a lot of it is to do with the misdirection, the sort of the misstep just before where you think it's just a call, and so it's a reaction to the surprise when she's actually there. I also think it's the shot. I think it's the line turnaround. I think it's the shot where, you know, you slowly reveal her when he turns around in the airport. Just it's a combination of things.
Lovely. Good. Love it. Mm. Come on, people.
Right. Final poster then before we leave the corridor and enter the foyer, enter the auditorium rather. This poster depicts your unpopular movie opinion.
So I went with Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which I think is a really beautiful piece of work with some extremely fine performances. Sandra Bullock, for me, was absolutely breathtaking in this. I just thought she was wonderful. I loved the book. I really looked forward to the film. Stephen Daldry is a brilliant creator of whatever it is that he turns his hand to. So yeah, it was a movie that I was really looking forward to. I saw it, loved it, and could not have anticipated it being the flop that it was.
And a flop it was. It's it didn't really connect with audiences. And I mean,
I think America just wasn't ready. That's what I think, retrospectively.
Ready to have a movie like that about
9/11.
About 9/11, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was just too close. And probably maybe the fact that it was made by an Englishman, even though Stephen was living in America at the time. So I can see external factors coming in and making an impact on the impact of the movie.
Okay. I mean, because critics didn't seem to love it either. I don't know your opinion on Rotten Tomatoes as a resource, but it's only got 45% on Rotten Tomatoes as a movie.
What can I say? I thought it was really, really fine filmmaking.
And that's why it's an unpopular movie opinion.
Exactly right.
Our final poster is for 2011's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Right, we push open the final set of doors into the auditorium. Now, there is a crowd of people hoping to join you and Alan Rickman in the cinema to watch whatever movie you're screening. Do you want to let them in? Do you want a busy auditorium? Or do you want it just you and Alan?
Oh, no, let's let the others in. Come on, it's a shared experience. That's the whole point.
Wonderful. The crowd go wild. They pour into the auditorium. Now, before we get to the movie you have picked to screen for us, we're going to play a few other things on the big screen. And the first thing we're going to do is play a trailer which depicts the movie you're most looking forward to seeing at the cinema.
Easy. Deadpool 3.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, come on.
All right. It's okay.
The future of Marvel is hanging on this movie.
So, I mean, what a lot of pressure for a film. You're absolutely right, though. This people are saying,
if anyone can take it, if anyone can take the pressure, it's this movie.
God, it's so scary. You're right, though. It's like people are saying this will either make or break the Marvel Universe. If this is going to either rescue it from the pit it's put itself in, or we are gonna watch the gradual demise of this glorious universe.
And do you know what? I'm ready for it to go either way. Because if it's brilliant, oh my God, I literally cannot wait. And if it's not good enough, then I want to be part of that too. I want to be witness to that too.
Well, it gives me goosebumps thinking
that,
about it.
It was that, right? Or Mission Impossible. The thing about Mission Impossible, almost each one was better than the last. I mean, 6 for me was absolutely, it blew my mind. It was so good. 7 for me was, I didn't quite enjoy it as much, but it was still brilliant. And then 8, you just think, I know he's going to save the best for last, but I sort of know what that's going to be. Whereas Deadpool, I think, has got more hanging on it.
Yeah, he's Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman. Oh, it's
big. It's big. Come on, people.
It's big. So 6, I agree with you, though. Mission Impossible Fallout, that was the 6th one. Just blinding, a blinding piece of cinema.
Absolutely brilliant piece of cinema from every angle.
Right then, let's play something else on the big screen now. And this is the movie moment that makes you literally or metaphorically pump your fist in the air.
This is the moment when the chief escapes at the very end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Oh,
that's good. That's you need something after what happens to a poor Jack Nicholson's character, don't you?
You do. Amazing movie, beautifully directed, astonishing performances, great cast. I mean, it's a if you've got to be in the right mood, but it's got everything. And for me, it's got that fist pump moment.
That's good. That's good. When did you see it? Did you see it when you were quite young?
I remember, I think I probably did see it. Funnily enough, I saw a stage version because it was originally a play when was I was at university.
That wasn't the... Oh, okay. I remember Christian...
No, small version, but...
Right.
Christian Slater did, yeah, no, I didn't see that. No, I'm talking about before when I was at uni. Somebody did it. And then I did a play with Danny DeVito. And inspired by him and being with him, I watched it again. So that was probably sort of 10 years ago, maybe. And then watched it again during COVID with my kids. That's a big favourite.
Just because I've never had the chance to interview him either. Danny DeVito, lovely guy.
Lovely guy. Ugh. Absolute gold.
Brilliant. Right then, let's play something else on the big screen. This is what you consider cinema's most shocking moment.
Well, again, got to go with your instinct when you get these questions. And I've got to go with the first time I saw Jaws. I'd never seen the like. Oh, my God. Just breathtaking.
Okay.
Even now, I've been on the ride at Universal so many times, but still, I love it. I love it when the crappy fake shark comes up. But that moment, seeing it in the cinema, that would be a great one to screen nowadays.
Oh yeah. I'll pull back the curtain on my side. I'm not sure you can see that. I've got a shark tattooed on my wrist. That was because I watched Jaws when I was 5, and I'm convinced I've never been in the sea since. And I'm worried that if I ever got drunk on a beach, I might forget that and go in the sea. So I look down, and this reminds me not to ever go in the sea because sharks.
Yeah. Well, let's just say that my youngest son was, in my view, too young to watch it when he first saw it. And I feel that because I remember coming home and he was sitting on the stairs where he could just about still see the screen. And I was thinking, wait, what's going on? And when I saw what movie was on, I was like, oh my God, no! And I think she was probably about 5 or 6. So I'll look out for the shark tattoo that's clearly going to be on his wrist before we know it.
Has he been in the sea since watching Jaws?
Yeah.
Okay.
He has. He's a big swimmer, so he's fine. He's all good.
That's great. Yeah. What a legendary piece of cinema. I love it. Right. Let's play something through the Dolby Atmos speakers in this cinema. The line or piece of dialogue from a movie that most affected you?
Tough question, but I'm going to go with Let's Keep Going. Thelma and Louise, very, very end of the movie. I think Susan Sarandon says, are you sure? And Gina Davis says, yes. And that's that. And they keep going.
They keep going. And why does it affect you so much? What was it about it?
I think that if that isn't one of the best depictions of courage and bravery and doing what feels like the right thing against all the odds, I don't know what it is. I just think it's a beautiful act of friendship and togetherness and, yeah, just a sense of, I just think keep going is a really good mantra also, just to keep with you. You know, we all have those really tough moments and you just think, oh my God, this is just too much. I can't do it. Whether it's a particular day or a moment or a lengthy moment in your life, doesn't matter. If you can feel you've got that little voice, inner voice saying, keep going, it always gets better.
Well said.
And the fact that it was two women, so powerful. That whole movie. So powerful, so brilliant.
And an ending that almost never was as a filmmaker yourself. I don't know if you've ever had to butt heads with a studio or a production company, because obviously the studio was like, well, they can't die. That's stupid. No, we've got to find a way for them to survive. And then there was a version where just Gina Davis survived. She got out of the car and Susan Sarandon went over the cliff. And in the end, I think Ridley Scott managed to go, let's just do it my way.
Yeah. Listen, that's part of the job, is having those moments where, whether it's your, this is why you need a Graham Broadbent with you. because even when Graham and I disagree on something, we always get there. And I feel really confident that if you've got the right person in the boat with you, if they disagree with you, often it's for a good reason. And it either makes you see things in a way that you just hadn't seen it from that point of view. And there is a better answer, which is the one that you just think, oh my God, thank God we're doing this together. But equally, it can give you the reverse feeling where it makes you feel even more that you know instinctively that you're right. And you have to find your way of persuading them why it is that your instinct is telling you whatever it is. Mm. And often you find the answer through that route too. So, you know, bumping heads is not necessarily a bad thing.
I think it's often called the most collaborative form of art filmmaking. So I guess that's what we're saying here. That's what we're saying.
Yeah.
All right. The final thing we need before you announce the movie you are screening for us tonight is what you, Thea, consider the best use of music in a movie.
Okay. So of all your questions, this for me is way the hardest.
Okay.
I honestly could give you about 15 examples just off the top of my head. And I would like to give you some others, but if you're going to make me choose...
Do you want to do... If you can do it, we've got enough time for you to do a very quick top three. If you want to do a three, if you want to just make sure they get name checked.
Well, we've already done The Big Chill, which the use of music in that is superb. Do the Right Thing, also absolutely superb. Romeo and Juliet, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet for me. Mm. Almost Famous, Tiny Dancer, massive. What about, do you remember the moment when Layla kicks in Goodfellas?
Oh!
Which is,
the montage where they discover all the bodies.
Exactly. Yeah. Superb. The moment we all first saw Whitney Houston singing I Will Always Love You. In The Bodyguard, again, huge. Thelma and Louise, actually, the whole soundtrack of that is brilliant.
Okay, so based on
John Williams, just about anything, Deer Hunter.
What has pipped all
these?
I'm
gonna go with Prince and Purple Rain in Purple Rain. Not my favorite movie, maybe, in the whole world, but one of the greatest performers of all time, singing one of the best songs of all time in its entirety, so beautifully captured. It's a bit of a cheat, but it is a great use of music in film.
Purple Rain echoes round the auditorium and falls silent because now it is time to announce, Thea, of all the movies out there, which film have you picked to screen for us tonight? What are we watching, Thea?
We are watching The Deer Hunter.
Tell
it's
me
big.
Why.
I know.
Michael Cimino's Deer
Hunter.
It's
beautiful. Yeah. It's just got everything. Music included. Exceptional performances. It goes from a tiny micro world and explodes into these boys' lives exploding into this huge journey that they go on. It kind of confronts the Vietnam War in a way that not many movies do with such authenticity and beauty. Meryl Streep, I mean, there's just, De Niro is utterly superb. The editing, it's one of the best edited movies ever, I think. So, it's a real ride. Another thing about it that I absolutely love. For me, the best movies are ones that are not, you never think of them as, oh, that could work as a play, or, oh, that's, you're thinking of it as a book. But it's so cinematic. It's just unbeatable.
And very much a movie that is something of a time capsule. I don't know that we're ever going to see a film like that again. What do you think? Because the pacing is so slow, but it's never not engrossing. But in this day and age, do you think there is a chance we might see another film of the scale and style that The Deer Hunter is?
Do Do you know what? I'd like to say I hope so, because I also think, I feel like we're big enough and ready enough to, and kind of, I think the younger generations in particular are possibly ready to go full circle. We live in a world at the moment where everything has to be, everyone demands an immediate response. And everything, you can fit everything into like 15-second segments. And at some point, that is going to have to turn back the other way. And it's funny because you describe it, you're right. There's a kind of longueur to it, but it's so delicately cut that you never, ever get bored for 1 minute. And it gives you the time to get into these boys in particular, their real beings as they go to war and experience that. And I think we will see it again.
Well, let's hope so, because that would be lovely. And perhaps the likes of Oppenheimer doing so well at the box office and the Oscars, maybe things are changing. Well, we'll see.
There you go. Very, very, very good moment to bring in Oppenheimer as an example. Mm. Very good.
We'll see. Maybe we want Deadpool 3 to fail and the MCU to die so we can get another Deer Hunter. I'm not saying that should happen. Right.
There's room for both. Come on. There's got to be room for both.
There's room for both.
It's like if you've got two movies coming out at the same time. There's got to be room for both, right?
Yeah, exactly. Let's hope so. It's happening right now in America for you. Now, that is it. The credits are rolling on the Deer Hunter. The curtains are closing. The crowd are milling out, smiling, thanking you for taking them on a wonderful evening out at the cinema. But before I let you go, it's time for this week's mystery question as we ask, what's in the box?
I saw you with the box. What was in the box? Oh, what's in the box?
So I'm seeing this for the first time. This is coming from one of our lovely trippers, and they say, okay. Oh, this is funny, seeing as you mentioned Deadpool 3 is the movie you're most looking forward to. Thea, would you ever consider directing a superhero movie? And if so, for what character?
Absolutely, I would. Oh, which character? Well, what if the new James Gunn does it with Superman in the way that he's done it with other movies of this ilk?
Yeah, Guardians.
And Lois Lane suddenly becomes the next hero figure. And you've got to have a woman at the helm of that, haven't you?
I love it. We're positioning Lois Lane as a new DC. So this is in the DCU, and you're saying Lois Lane, a movie about Lois Lane. This is exciting. I like this. It's good. I do remember a weird story that Sony were once planning on, in their Spider-Man universe, making an Aunt May solo movie. So that sounds crazy. This sounds better. Right. Your taxi has arrived to ferry you back to reality. But before you go, let's recap, Thea, your perfect trip to the movies. You are going with your friend, the late, great Alan Rickman, at 8 p.m. And you are sitting in the middle of the middle. The only snack you need is some warm, sweet popcorn. We leave the foyer and start putting up posters of your most important movie memories. Your fondest movie memory poster is all three original Indiana Jones posters. Next up, the poster that depicts your worst movie memory. It was watching The Force Awakens because Han Solo dies and it broke you. The next poster we're putting up depicts the last performance that brought you to tears, and it's the Andrew Scott and Claire Foy bed scene in the wonderful All of Us Strangers. And finally, your unpopular movie opinion is that Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close is a much better film than it was given credit for. We leave the corridor. You're allowing the crowd to join you in the auditorium. We're playing the trailer for the MCU savior, potentially Deadpool 3. The movie moment that makes you pump your fist in the air is the Chief's escape at the end of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Cinema's most shocking moment, the first time you saw Jaws. And the line of dialogue that most affected you, Let's Keep Going, from Thelma and Louise. The best use of music in a movie. There were so many to choose from, but you picked Purple Rain from Purple Rain. And finally, you are screening for us Michael Cimino's The Deer Hunter. What an incredible trip. All that's left to do is for me to ask you, Thea, have you had a good time?
I've had a great time. Thank you so much for taking me down memory lane, as well as projecting me forward. I've loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Well, I've loved chatting to you, and congratulations again on the beautiful game hitting Netflix on March the 29th. Well done. A cracking movie. Unsurprisingly, finding out you're a football fan, it's great fun.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Ralph. Thank you.
And as Thea's cab carries her out of this dimension, away from our virtual cinema, back to reality, we must all leave her movie paradise as well. But before I say my final farewell for this episode, don't forget, you can find the full video for today's Thea Sharrock interview, and indeed for every guest on our Trip to the Movies YouTube channel. So please head over there, and as I said at the start, help us grow the podcast by hitting subscribe. And that really is it. I'll be back next week when another guest fills our cinema with their celluloid dreams as they take us on a trip to the movies. Bye-bye.